I can lift you up. I could show you what you want to see. I'll take you where you want to be.
Thank God we don't play professional music. Here on SRN1, it's all indie. Catch the spirit, SRN1.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. You're missing out. What are you missing out on? Only the best way to spend your Wednesday nights. Tune in to SRN1 Wednesday nights for Hotspot Radio, playing all of your requests in dozens of unique and fun themes. Hosted by yours truly, DJ Thuban, and my husband, DJ Bolo, Hotspot Radio is a furry, Theri and Otherkin hosted show in its 10th season of broadcasting over the internet airwaves. So join us Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Want to know more? Check out our website, hotspotradio.net, and be sure to tell your friends so they don't miss out, too. We'll see you there.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
Fine wine of select gripes. Tovino Veritas, live from Burbank.
I may be joking, but I'm never kidding. Join me each Thursday at 11 p.m. right here on SRN.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the plains of silence.
Tovino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
The following program is intended for mature audiences.
Good evening, this is Saul Manila with the Veritas News. What just turned six? The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare by some, and the worst thing that could possibly ever happen on the planet by others. But thanks to the new GOP budget, the Obamacare will not see seven. The current GOP controlled Senate has just effectively repealed Obamacare by allocating exactly $0 to the healthcare system. While pharmaceutical corporados and others in the healthcare industry applaud the GOP's stick-to-itiveness, the 20 million people covered by Obamacare are calling the GOP's stick-to-itiveness their stick-it-to-itiveness. Progressives, Democrats, and other grassroots activists now lament their attempts at getting Republicans to do their job, since the GOP apparently sees their job as aiding and abetting terrorists by eliminating the United States healthcare system. Just 2 days after the deadly horror in Brussels, ISIS, who has taken responsibility for the bombings, has promised even greater revenge upon the West. While many experts on terrorism try to guess ISIS's next move, many fear that the seeds of ISIS's next catastrophe are already planted and rooting in the United States of America in the form of the presidential campaign and perhaps win of Trumpet Man Donald Trump. Exhibiting his inexperience and lack of foresight in the fight against terrorists, Donald Trump's team is recruiting women dentists, ostensibly with smaller hands, to form the core of security personnel at Guantanamo Bay. When pushed for his reasoning, the Trumpet Man asked, "Who better than a dentist to perform a cavity search?" Former late-night talk show host David Letterman was spotted with a shaved head and extra-long bushy gray beard jogging in his hometown this afternoon. When asked for his reaction to the spotting, former guest of the talk show and current orangutan candidate Donald Trumpetman Trump, asked, "Why was Letterman holding someone's head, and whoever heard of a beard jogging?" This has been Sal Manella with the Veritas News. Now here's Tom Savino with Savino Veritas.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 Ready.
We're ready for the road.
California, land of fantasy and make-believe. It's Savino Veritas. Featuring host, writer, humorist, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Savino. Now, here he is with Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, Tom Savino.
Greetings and salutations. Tom Savino here with another Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, the fine wine of select gripes, coming to you live from Burbank, California, from the Lion's Den Studios. We're not foolproof. We're not soundproof. We are 90 proof. Thanks for joining us here at 148.ca/1. We are here every Thursday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, at 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and all the other international times in between. And of course, as always, 24/7 on the JuicedTalk.com website. The Too Cool for School, JuicedTalk.com. We have much from which to pick from the Savino Veritas grapevine tonight, so let's get right to it, shall we? Sal Manila reported just moments ago that David Letterman was spotted jogging with a long gray beard. Well, in remembrance of his smooth shavenness of not so long ago, here's a spoof and a parody of David Letterman that illustrates the truth about genetically modified organisms and what I call food-like substances.
You don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
Hey, kids, we have a great show for you tonight. Carrot Top 2.0 is here.
Oh.
But first, tonight's countdown, the top five pickup lies, lines, we juiced-up GMO bros use on the genetically unenhanced ladies. Do you ever tell any lies, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we go. Number five. I'm all about the Benjamins. GMO equals big money, baby.
Well, for big biotech. For farmers, it's a life of economic indenture.
Are you saying that farmers have bad teeth? I mean, that's a bit offensive, Paul. Indenture. What does that even mean?
It means that contractually, they're obligated to buy new seed every year or face legal action. And, of course, the cost to the environment, unforeseen health risks, and the potential destruction of the natural food chain all should really be factored in. Sorry, Dave.
Number four. I do a lot of charity work. I'm all about helping the poor.
Well, that's nice, especially since we GMOs bankrupt thousands of small farmers every year.
All right, moving on. Number three, I feed the world with bigger and better crops. Now, Paul, you have to admit we GMOs are bigger and much better looking than those natural veggies.
Oh, right on, Dave. You ever meet my friend Lance? He is the biggest, reddest strawberry I've ever seen. And with his frog genes, he has an incredible vertical leap. Although he is always talking about jumping out of the lab, spreading his superior frogberry genes, taking over the world and destroying all weak organic strawberries.
It sounds a bit frightening.
Yeah.
Number two, the birds and the bees, baby. I'm so green.
Oh, yeah, Dip. Wait, what's the big idea?
Now, Paul, I don't want to hear about the decimation of bee populations, the pollution of the water table, or the extinction of weaker, unworthy species.
Hold on, Dave.
And the number one lie we tell our non-GMO friends is, I'm too sexy for my genes. Can we get our friends in biotech to do something about Paul's genes? Maybe a modification that leaves him mute.
Hey, I heard that.
Celebrity voices impersonated.
Oh, you're kidding. Well, they do a good job, Dave.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
And they found that the genes that were inserted into soybeans transferred into the DNA of the bacteria living inside us, and certain varieties of genetically modified corn are engineered to produce an insecticide living inside us.
I'm looking at the food that's in the grocery store. They say it's safe, everybody eat more. On second thought, I don't really know if it's made with those GMOs. So I'm looking for the non-GMO label. Before I bring it home, I put it on the table. I want to know if it's verified, so I don't harm myself with genetically modified.
They don't want you to know.
They don't want you to know.
Poison they grow.
Profits the show.
From those GMOs.
Seeds that they sow.
Gonna hurt us, we know.
Told them to go.
Say GMO, no.
Hey, look. I don't wanna eat poison. I don't want gene mutations at my dinner reservations. It's a food abomination. What they're doing to this fast food nation. They take artificial gene combinations, inject it in seed variations so they can grow their frankenfood imitations while the side effects cause medical patients. Keep the profits alive while they're spraying all the food with name brand herbicides. And all the while they're spreading their lies. Monsanto destroy a farmer's lives. And the FDA just keeps it all going, saying it's safe even though they all know it's just poison, stealing the way your life, and that's what you eat. Genetically modified.
They don't want you to know.
Poison they grow.
Profits they show.
GMO, no.
Seeds that they sow.
Gonna hurt us, we know.
Told them to go.
Say GMO, no.
Myth.
If you don't believe me, listen to Jeffrey Smith. He's the man with the plan, gonna do what he can to help us all get those GMOs banned. But we need you to lend a hand, take a stand against this food stand. It's a mission for the health condition worldwide, cause we don't wanna live genetically modified.
No testing necessary, no
infections
living inside us. No testing necessary, no infections living inside us.
Don't eat food unless you know what's in it. Don't believe the propaganda, the press will spin it. Affects everybody, we all up in it. Stand up to Monsanto, tell him, oh no you didn't. Reject Franken foods in the store. Demand honest labels so we can be informed. We have a natural right to know what we buying. Just say no to GMO before our farms start dying. Just say no to GMO. These corporate crooks are lying. Just say no to GMO. This time we're not complying. Just say no to GMO. We just not buying it. Just say no to GMO.
No testing necessary. No insecticide.
Just say no to GMO.
No testing necessary. No insecticide.
Just say no to GMO.
Good and evil are either or both realities? Every day I battle with myself not to see people who hold different opinions and values as wrong, or worse yet, evil. But what correct or good reason is there to murder over 30 people with explosives? What good is there? in words and the intent of those same murderers who proudly then say, the next attack will be more widespread, God willing. God willing. What sort of mind harbors such a view, of God? Is that a good mind? Is that an evil mind? Is revenge ever good? I guess if you're the one seeking it, it's good. And of course, to all the victims and the survivors of victims, it certainly seems evil. Sometimes the battle to secure what we at least think is good over what we at least think as evil, it seems futile. Here in this country, the money and power that goes along with that, it almost always seems to crush the good. But we carry on with our fight, and sometimes, enough good people with truly good intentions prevails. This past week, somehow, some way, amidst the most evil and contemptuous Congress that's ever existed in my lifetime, somehow we were able to defeat the so-called Dark Act that would have prevented individual states and local communities from ever enacting laws or regulations requiring labeling of genetically modified food-like substances. For that, we are so grateful, but I know that the battle's not over. If you don't have the money on your side, we must fight back with information and knowledge.
I am a rancher in Bend, Oregon. We should know what we're eating. We should know what we're feeding our children, our grandchildren.
Knowledge is power. And if we know what's in our food, if we know what's in our water, then we can make better choices.
As a farmer, I can't understand why I wouldn't tell my clients. I invite my clients to come see the farm. I want them to know the kind of food they're eating. I'm proud of it.
I want to know what I'm feeding my children. I want to know what I'm eating.
Very simple for companies to label foods for genetically engineered ingredients, just like they label them for calorie content, protein.
64 other countries require labeling.
Seeds of genetically engineered corn. And you may wonder why they're not yellow. These seeds are coated with up to 4, sometimes 5, different chemicals.
But 99% of GMO crops in America are engineered for heavy herbicide use, or they produce insecticide inside the cell of every plant.
If you can identify a GMO product, you can pretty much assume that it's been grown with really high levels of herbicide. And, you know, that's not on the box either.
And as somebody who's very concerned about eating healthy, I want to reduce the amount of pesticides that I put into my body.
Because I was a farm worker, my parents were farm workers, and we know what pesticides does to farm workers and to farmers when they're exposed to it.
It's a minimal thing to ask that we know what's in our food.
And the genetically engineered food offers many questions.
Our family is fifth generation Oregon farmers, and we farm about 4,500 acres.
One thing we're really concerned about with GMOs is the cross-contamination issue. We could end up with GMOs in our seeds, in the food we're growing.
I think the future of all farmers are threatened by genetically engineered crops.
The issue here is Monsanto thinks that if you know what they're selling you, you won't buy it.
I think I have a right to know what's in the salmon, if it's genetically engineered or not, because I grew up on the river and salmon is my life.
Not labeling genetically engineered salmon is an economic risk to the fishermen of this area.
Coming from a family that's commercial fished, we really support labeling of GMOs because that's our livelihood.
Quay engineered labeling is will benefit the consumer and the commercial fishing fleet.
That this is a way to protect your family. This is a way to make sure that you know what you're eating.
What I produce here on the farm, I'm very proud of.
Labeling helps family farms because it lets the consumer know which products are local family farms and which are genetically engineered crops that come in from out of state.
It doesn't cost anything to change a label.
in this state, it will help more farmers, I believe, survive.
Everyone has the right to know what's in their food.
As a family farm, we support the labeling of genetically engineered foods. We think it's really important for our community and all of Oregon.
Proud of the quality of our products, and we want to put that on our label. We want people to know.
GMO labeling, I see, is simply something that says to the consumer, this is what we're producing, and this is what's in that package.
It would create a great competitive advantage for Oregon, for all small agriculture within this state.
Moms everywhere have the right to know what they're feeding their children.
And I think about my children and my grandchildren and what they have to face in the future.
I don't want my grandchildren to be guinea pigs.
I think that the claims that this will raise the price of food or add to people's taxes are absurd.
Companies that sell food overseas already have to put the label on.
I don't see why this would increase food prices. It's simply adding one more thing to a label which already exists.
Labeling allows us to be able to clearly tell them this is a genetically modified product.
I'm asking all my family, friends, and all of my patients every day, please support the labeling of genetically engineered foods. In 64 other countries, there's labeled GMOs and people have the choice.
We can win, but it's going to take all of you, all of us working together.
We need everybody to reach deep, dig deep.
I really do believe that one state can change the nation.
We are protecting the future of our food.
Where it doesn't matter whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent.
California couldn't do it, Washington couldn't do it, but Oregon, we can do this. We can make this happen.
The ground game, the grassroots energy that we've got here, I mean, it's huge. And the other side cannot buy that.
You can be part of history. You could make a difference, and we can create history and change not only Oregon, but America.
Maybe someday we'll even go beyond just labeling GMOs, genetically modified food-like substances. Maybe they'll be outlawed. They should have never been on the face of the earth. Anyway, in the triumph that we experienced this week in succeeding against the DARC Act, it's good to acknowledge those good companies or those good people, or at least the good that they did this time. Right after that decision by the Congress, Kellogg's, Mars, Campbell's, and Campbell's I think was the first, and General Mills immediately announced that they will, on their labels, label genetically modified foods, food-like substances. So we applaud them. And we especially applaud, I think it was Mars or maybe all four, that admitted what we have been saying all along, that to label genetically modified ingredients cost nothing more than before.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
You know, David Letterman's shaved head, that's the one that's sitting on his shoulders, not the one he's carrying around, as Donald Trump thought. David Letterman's shaved head and long, long beard are reminiscent of the Boston Red Sox World Championship team of just a few years ago. Now, I know David is a staunch New York Yankees fan, as I am. And speaking of good and evil, there can be no good at all coming from the Red Sox if you are a Yankee fan. And nothing but evil coming from the Yankee Stadium if you're a Red Sox fan. But has Letterman turned? Has he gone rogue? Is he now evil? We may never know. Only time will tell. In the meantime, here are the top 10 reasons why David Letterman grew a long beard. The top 10 reasons why David Letterman grew a long beard. 10. Now out of a job. To save money in hiring Santas for Christmas. To save time on after shower grooming by making belly button lint removal obsolete. Number 8. Because lying on his back at the beach no longer requires frontal sunblock. Number 7. To hide his most recent poor application of a Jay Leno chest tattoo. Number 6. So he can secretly order high fat content pastrami sandwiches at the Hello Deli. Number 5 of the top 10 reasons David Letterman grew a long gray beard. Number 5. He's considering infiltrating a homegrown terrorist cell. Number 4. Because the constant rubbing of his beard against his chest delivers pleasant and ceaseless nipple stimulation. Number 3. To disprove Gillette's guarantee that their blades will last 30 shaves. Number 2. He got sick and tired of ex-Broadway musical play veterans seeing him and singing, "We Got Stubble Right Here on Mr. Witty." And finally, the number one reason why David Letterman grew a long gray beard. Number 1. To prank Donald Trump and broker a bogus deal with Cuba, allowing retired comedians free access to Havana Beach Resorts and Trump Hotels.
It's the Fabulous Geek Show.
All tied up, ready.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards.
JuiceTalk.com.
You're listening to Tom Savino on Savino Veritas. With you here this Thursday night and every Thursday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and all the other international times in between. And you just heard a promotion for JuicedTalk.com. That's J-U-I-C-E-D Talk.com. JuicedTalk.com, the Too Cool for School website, JuicedTalk.com. And in addition to Savino Veritas on JuiceTalk.com, you can get to hear the Cotolo Chronicles. Welcome back, Frank Cotolo, who is was suffering from some respiratory illnesses and is back on the air. Welcome back, Frank Cotolo. So you can hear Cotolo Chronicles, the artist Dee and Anne Marie. You can also hear Velvet Steel. The Artist D Show, and my show, which is this show. I forgot the name of the show. The Savino Veritas. How can I forget the name of my own show, which is my own name? I forgot that. Well, then I guess it would not be a good candidate for terrorist job. Somehow, I don't remember how, in the Savino Veritas archives, I was able to get my hands on a real Al-Qaeda job application. This is for real, an Al-Qaeda job application. This sounds like a bit, and I'll try to make this as funny as possible. But once again, good and evil. It's our theme tonight, good and evil. What is good? What is evil? Do they exist? Is there a good? Is there an evil? Do they both exist? Do neither exist? What's the story with good and evil? Well, here's an Al-Qaeda job application. These are the questions. These are the questions. How much of the Holy Quran have you memorized? Did you study Sharia?
I believe in total equality between man and woman. But that equality can only come about when the female partner is willing to confess her total inferiority.
Do you have any hobbies or pastimes? Who was your instructor? If so, what are they? What is your favorite material, science or literature? I guess they mean, what is your favorite reading material, science or literature? But far be it from me to criticize militant terrorists. I'm not going to go there. Are any of your relatives or friends in the jihad theater?
I don't think that's funny.
That's a real question. Are any of your relatives or friends in the jihad theater? I didn't know they had a theater. It's off Broadway? Off Broadway? The Jihad Theater. I understand they're using the word theater in the other sense of the word. But maybe there's some comedy there someplace. I mean, even though I don't want to irk these people, you can't let a good joke die. Of course, if there's any group around that could kill it, they would be the ones, yes. We'll see about that. Well, here's another question. List the types of passports you possess. Did you use a real or forged passport for your current travel? Obviously, that indicates that it's totally acceptable to have a forged passport. They would probably, the powers that be there, the administrators of these job applications, the people who hire Al-Qaeda terrorists, would probably help you get a forged passport. Next question. Do you wish to execute a suicide operation? I suppose they would modify this job application for people in the homegrown cells here in the United States, people who don't want to commit suicide. So the question would not be, do you wish to execute a suicide operation? Or do you wish, it probably would be, would you perform an operation that would who would you wish to execute? in a lethal operation? That would be a better question. If they need someone to rewrite their American version of this, I'd be very glad to help them. Next question. What objective would you like to accomplish on the jihad path? The jihad path.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Do you have any chronic or hereditary diseases? And who should we contact in case you become a martyr?
All right, let's roll. Hey, let's be careful out there.
That was the final question on the authentic Al-Qaeda job application. Final question, who should we contact in case you become a martyr? Now, I think there should have an additional question because this was, as I understand it, this application is a few years old, seriously. And they might want to add one final question because we are on to them a little bit and we are making headway and finding out things and stopping them and getting them here and there. We, the West, the United States, France, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, the Western nations, Brussels, people in Brussels, law enforcement. So they might, their final question perhaps might be, did you pack these bags yourself and did anyone else, have they been in your sight the whole time? And the last thing on the application, of course, is address and phone numbers, as all applications are. That's an authentic Al-Qaeda job application. That's for real. With a real deal here at Savino Veritas. Now, of course, as I mentioned, we in the West are fighting these terrorists, trying to get to the bottom of this. We have some major presidential candidates who are saying things like, what the hell's going on? We won't do anything until we know what the hell's going on, or we will just block these people from coming into the United States, or because until we know what's going on. Well, there is a lot we don't know what's going on. But I just want to mention this, that, of course, we think of Islam fighting Christianity, as it is obviously what's going on. That is part of what's going on. Their God's better than our God if you are Christian. And again, there may be Islamics listening to this, Muslims listening to this and saying, well, that's not the way it is. Not everybody's like this. Yes, we know not everybody's like this. But, you know, today the ISIS people said, quite frankly, they took responsibility for the bombings in Brussels and the many deaths and seemed sincerely to say the next event will be much larger, God willing. God willing. This is definitely a religious thing. There's not any doubt about that. And somehow they feel that we have infringed on their religion somehow. It's a very complicated thing. I am not, want to make light of it. There's a lot I don't know about it. But here is what I do want to tell you. That when I was studying Buddhism decades ago, and as I was studying Buddhism, I was learning all the things about Buddhism, all the doctrines, all the practices of Buddhism. And as I was gathering a knowledge of Buddhism and kind of internalizing it, the main thing I internalized about Buddhism was how compassionate it was, how a Buddhist would literally a good Buddhist would literally take a spider out of the house. If people in the house were afraid of the spider and were going to kill the spider, it would take a spider out of the house, bring it into the garden, and not destroy a life. So as I was developing this knowledge of Buddhism and how compassionate it was and is, I was totally taken aback when I read in a magazine called Mandala. Well, I don't think the magazine's around any longer. I hope I could find it somewhere in the archives, but decades ago, I'm reading in the Mandala magazine how Buddhism prophesized that in order for there to be healing and peace on this earth, Islam must be conquered, including violently if necessary. This really shocked me when I read this. And, you know, again, how compassionate and nonviolent the Buddhists are. And the Buddha said, violence begets violence. And yet I read this and I hear this and I say, wow, how can that be? How can that be, the Buddhist saying that? And this was, when I was reading this, by the way, it was well before 9/11. I suppose I'm not too knowledgeable of the history of this, but I guess there were people in Islam putting down Westerners and warning against Westerners. I'm sure back in the 70s, of course, and Iran taking the American hostages. So it wasn't like it was just out of the blue. But to read this in Mandala magazine, how the Buddhists prophesized that in order for there to be peace on this planet and healing of ills on this planet, Islam must be conquered and abolished and violently if necessary. It really shocked me. So then now, as I said, that was decades ago, so I've done some research since then, and I have come to come across some items here of interest. This is from Islam's War Against Buddhism. Islam's War Against Buddhism. This is quotations from this. Who said it? I didn't write down who said it. What kind of a research thing is this? But it is a quotation from Islam's War Against Buddhism. Quote, I feel through my direct experiences of it that Islam has not changed its ways in the least. In fact, it has become more aggressive now than at any time since its period of greatest expansion in the 900s to the 1200s. Modern Islam, quote, the word modern is quotations, modern Islam seeks to return humanity to those very same times, a revival of the dark ages of Islamic slaughter, mayhem, and pillage, all in the name of Allah. We Buddhists must realize that we and our cherished practices would be swept away entirely and crushed utterly should Islam ever gain ascendancy in this world in which we live. Islam is the only belief that propagates itself thus by the sword, and it is very patient. That was from Islam's War Against Buddhism. And this now is from Holy Wars in Buddhism and Islam, The Myth of Shambhala, the full version by Alexander Berzin. This was written in November 2001 and revised in December 2006. This can be seen online. Holy Wars in Buddhism and Islam, The Myth of Shambhala, or Shambhala. I forget which is correct. Maybe neither or neither or both. Anyway, here I shall read from this, from Alexander Berzin. It's a summary. Often when people think of the Muslim concept of jihad or holy war, they associate with it the negative connotation of a self-righteous campaign of vengeful destruction in the name of God to convert others by force. They may acknowledge that Christianity had an equivalent with the Crusades, but not usually view Buddhism as having anything similar. After all, they say Buddhism is a religion of peace and does not have the technical term holy war. A careful examination of Buddhist texts, however, particularly the Kalachakra Tantra, literature, reveals both external and internal levels of battle that could easily be called holy wars. An unbiased study of Islam reveals the same. In both religions, leaders may exploit the external dimensions of holy war for political, economic, or personal gain by using it to rouse their troops to battle. Historical examples regarding Islam are well known, but one must not be rosy-eyed about Buddhism and think that it has been immune to this phenomenon. Nevertheless, in both religions, the main emphasis is on the internal spiritual battle against one's own ignorance and destructive ways. Analysis: military imagery in Buddhism. Shakyamuni Buddha was born into the Indian warrior caste and often used military imagery to describe the spiritual journey. I can attest to that, says Tom Savino, commenting now. He was the triumphant one who defeated the demonic forces, Mara, M-A-R-A, of unawareness, distorted views, disturbing emotions, and impulsive karmic behavior. That's the demonic forces, Mara, are unawareness, distorted views, disturbing emotions, and impulsive karmic behavior. The 8th century Common Era Indian Buddhist master Shantideva employs the metaphor of war repeatedly throughout his book, engaging in bodhisattva behavior. The real enemy to defeat, he said, the real enemy to defeat are the disturbing emotions and the attitudes that lie behind them. That lie hidden in the mind. The Tibetans translate the Sanskrit term arhat, A-R-H-A-T, a liberated being, as a foe destroyer, someone who has destroyed the inner foes. From these examples, it would appear that in Buddhism, the call for a holy war is purely an internal spiritual matter. The Kalachakra Tantra, however, reveals an additional external dimension. The legend of Shambhala. According to tradition, Buddha taught the Kalachakra Tantra in Andhra, South India, in 880 BCE to the visiting king of Shambhala, Suchandra, and his entourage. King Suchandra brought the teachings back to his northern land, where they have flourished ever since. Shambhala is a human realm, not a Buddhist pure land where all conditions are conducive to Kalachakra practice. Although an actual location on earth may represent it, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama explains that Shambhala exists purely as a spiritual realm. Despite the traditional literature describing the physical journey there, the only way to reach it is by intense Kalachakra meditation practice. 7 generations of kings after Suchandra, in 176 BCE, King Manjushri Yashas gathered the religious leaders of Shambhala, specifically the Brahmin wise men, to give them predictions and a warning 800 years in the future, namely in 624 of the Common Era, a non-Indic religion will arise in Mecca. Because of a lack of unity among the Brahmins people and laxity in following correctly the injunctions of their Vedic scriptures, many will accept this religion far in the future when its leaders threaten an invasion. To prevent this danger, Manjushri Yashas united the people of Shambhala into a single Vajra caste by conferring upon them the Kalachakra empowerment. By his act, the king became the first Kalki, the first holder of the caste. He then composed the abridged Kalachakra Tantra, which is the version of the Kalachakra Tantra that is presently extant. The non-Indic invaders. As the founding of Islam dates from in 622 of the Common Era, 2 years before Kalachakra's predicted date, most scholars identify the non-Indic religion with that faith. Descriptions of the religion elsewhere in the Kalachakra text as having the slaughter of cattle while reciting the name of its god, circumcision, veiled women, and prayer 5 times a day facing its holy land reinforce their conclusion. The Sanskrit term for non-Indic here is Melcha. Melcha, M-L-E-C-C-H-A, in Tibet, is called Lalo, meaning someone who speaks incomprehensibly in a non-Sanskrit tongue. Hindus and Buddhists alike have applied it to all foreign invaders of North India, starting with the Macedonians and Greeks in the time of Alexander the Great. The other major Sanskrit term used is Tayi, T-A-Y-I, Tayi, which derives from the Persian term for Arabs, used, for instance, in the reference to the Arab invaders of Iran in the mid-7th century CE. The first Kalki further described the future non-Indic religion as having a line of 8 great teachers: Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Mani, Muhammad, and Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I. Muhammad will come to Baghdad in the land of Mecca. This passage helps to identify the invaders within the Islamic community. Muhammad lived between 570 and 632 CE in Arabia. Baghdad, however, was built only in 762 CE as the capital of the Arab Abbasid Caliphate, which was from 750 to 1258 CE. Mani was a 3rd century Persian who founded an eclectic religion, Manichaeism, which, like the earlier Iranian religion, Zoroastrianism, emphasized the struggle between forces of good and evil. Within Islam, he would have been accepted perhaps as a prophet, although it is not clear that he ever was, only by the heretical Manichaean Islamic sect found among some officials in the early Abbasid court in Baghdad. The Abbasid caliphs severely persecuted its followers. Another point here: Buddhist scholars from present-day Afghanistan and the Indian subcontinent worked in Baghdad during the latter part of the 8th century CE, translating Sanskrit texts into Arabic. Another point: Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I, will be a future ruler, I-M-A-N, Iman, descendant from Muhammad, who will lead the faithful to Jerusalem restore Quranic law and order, and unite the followers of Islam in a single political state before the apocalypse that ends the world. He is the Islamic equivalent of a Messiah. The concept of Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I, became prominent only during the early Abbasid period, with three claimants to the title: a caliph, a rival in Mecca, and a martyr in whose name an anti-Abbasid rebellion was led. The full concept of Mahdi as a Messiah, however, did not appear until the end of the 9th century CE. Next point, the Ismaili Shia list of the prophets is the same as that found in the Kalachakra, only minus Mani, M-A-N-I. The Ismailis are the only Islamic sect that asserts Mahdi as a prophet. Next point. Ismaili Shia was the official sect of Islam followed in Multan, present-day northern Sindh in Pakistan, during the second half of the 10th century. Multan was an ally of the Ismaili Fatimid Empire, centered in Egypt and challenging the Abbadis for supremacy over the Islamic world. From this evidence, we may postulate that the Kalachakra description of the non-Indic invaders was based on the Ismailis of Multan in the late 10th century, mixed with some aspects of the Manchian Muslims of the late 8th century. The compilers of this description would most likely have been Buddhist masters living under Hindu Shahi rule in eastern Afghanistan and Adyanya, Swat Valley, present-day northwestern Pakistan. Buddhist monasteries in the Kabul region of Afghanistan, such as Subahar, had architectural motifs similar to those in the Kalachakra Mandala. Odiana was one of the main regions in which Buddhist Tantra developed. Moreover, Odiana had close contact with Kashmir, where the Buddhist and Hindu Shaivite Tantra flourished. A major Buddhist pilgrimage route connected the two. Thus, we must look to Buddhist-Muslim relations in eastern Afghanistan, Odiana, and Kashmir during the Abbasid period to understand the context of its teachings on history and holy wars. The prophecy of an apocalyptic war. The first Kalki predicted that the followers of the non-Indic religion will someday rule India from their capital in Delhi. Their king, Krinmata, will attempt the conquest of Shambhala in 2424 CE. This is a prediction, a prophecy. I'll read that again. The first Kalki predicted that the followers of the non-Indic religion will someday rule India from their capital in Delhi. Their king, Krinmati, will attempt the conquest of Shambhala in 2424 in the Common Era. The commentaries suggest that Krinmati will be recognized as the Messiah Mahdi. The 25th Kalki, Rudra Chakran will then invade India and defeat the non-Indics in a great war. His victory will mark the end of the Kali Yagu, the age of disputes, during which Dharma practice will degenerate. Afterwards, a new golden age will follow during which the teachings will flourish, especially those of Kalachakra. The idea of a war between the forces of good and evil, ending with an apocalyptic battle led by a messiah, first appeared in Zoroastrianism, founded in the 6th century BCE, several decades before Buddha was born. It entered Judaism sometime between the 2nd century BCE and the 2nd century CE. Subsequently, it made its way into early Christianity and Manichaeism, and later into Islam. A variation of the apocalyptic theme also appeared in Hinduism in the Vishnu Purana, dated approximately the 4th century CE. It relates that at the end of the Kali Yuga, Vishnu will appear in his final incarnation as Kalki, taking birth in the village of Shambhala as the son of the Brahmin Vishnu Yashas. He will defeat the non-Indics of the time who follow a path of destruction and will reawaken the minds of the people. Afterwards, in keeping with the Indian concept of cyclic time, a new golden age will follow rather than a final judgment and the end of the world, as in the non-Indic versions of the theme. It is difficult to establish whether the Vishnu Purana account derived from foreign influences and was adapted to the Indian mentality or arose independently. In keeping with Buddha's skillful means of teaching with terms and concepts familiar to his audience, the Kali Chakra Tantra also uses the names and images from the Vishnu Purana. Its stated audience, after all, was primarily educated Brahmins. The names not only include Shambhala, Kalki, and Kali Yuga, and a variant of Vishnu Yashas, Manjushri Yashas, but also the same term Mlekha, M-L-E-C-C-H-A, for the non-Indic bent on destruction. In the Kala Chakra version, however, the war has a symbolic meaning. The symbolic meaning of war, in the abridged Kala Chakra Tantra, Manjushri Yashas explains that the fight with the non-Indic people of Mecca is not an actual war, since the real battle is within the body. The 15th century Common Era Gelug commentator Kindrubje elaborates that Manjushri Yashas' words do not suggest an actual campaign to kill the followers of the non-Indic religion. The first Kalki's sententious in describing the details of the war was to provide a metaphor for the inner battle of deep blissful awareness, of voidness against unawareness and destructive behavior. Manjushri Yashas clearly enumerates the hidden symbolism. Radrashkarshan represents the, quote, mind Vajra, end quote. By the way, Vajra is like a lightning bolt. Vajra means lightning bolt, and the symbol is many items and ritual paraphernalia of Buddhists. Anyway, it represents the mind Vajra, namely the clear light subtlest mind. Shambhala represents the state of great bliss in which the mind Vajra abides. Being a Kalki means that mind Vajra has the perfect level of deep awareness, namely simultaneously arising voidness and bliss. Rudra Chakran's two generals, Rudra and Hanuman, stand for the two supporting kinds of deep awareness, that of the Prachakabudas and the Veshravakas. The 12 Hindu gods who helped win the war represent the cessation of the 12 links of dependent arising and of the 12 daily shifts of the karmic breaths. The links and the shifts both describe the mechanism perpetuating samsara. The four divisions of Rudra Chakran's army represent the purest levels of the four immeasurable attitudes of love, compassion, joy, and equality. The non-Indic forces that Rudra Chakran and the divisions of his army defeat represent the minds of negative karmic forces assisted by hatred, malice, resentment, and prejudice. Victory over them is the attainment of the path to liberation and enlightenment. The Buddhist didactic method. Despite textual disclaimers of calling for an actual holy war, the implication here that Islam is a cruel religion characterized by hatred, malice, and destructive behavior can easily be used as evidence to support that Buddhism is anti-Muslim. Although some Buddhists of the past may in fact have had this bias, and some Buddhists of today may likewise hold a sectarian view, one may also draw a different conclusion in light of one of the Mahayana Buddhist didactic methods. For example, Mahayana texts present certain views as characterizing Hinayana Buddhism, such as selflessly working for one's liberation alone, without regard for helping others. After all, the stated goal of Hinayana practitioners is self-liberation, not enlightenment for the sake of benefiting everyone. Although such description of Hinayana has led to prejudice, an educated objective study of Hinayana schools such as Theravada reveals a prominent role of meditation on love and compassion. One might conclude that Mahayana was simply ignorant of the actual Hinayana teachings. Alternatively, one might recognize that Mahayana is using here the method in Buddhist logic of taking positions to their absurd conclusions in order to help people avoid extremist views. The intention of this prasangika method is to caution practitioners to avoid the extreme of selfishness. The same analysis applies to the Mahayana presentations of the six schools of medieval Hindu and Jain philosophies. It also applies to each of the Tibetan Buddhist traditions' presentations of the views of each other and the views of the native Tibetan Bon tradition. Bon tradition is shamanic. It is a kind of a hybrid of Buddhism and shamanic practices. None of these presentations gives an accurate depiction. Each exaggerates and distorts certain features of the others to illustrate various points. The same is true of the Kalachakra assertions about the cruelty of Islam and its potential threat. Although Buddhist teachers may claim that the prasangika method here of using Islam to illustrate spiritual danger is a skillful means, one might also argue that it is grossly lacking in diplomacy, especially in modern times. The use of Islam to represent destructive, threatening forces, however, is understandable when examined in the context of the early Abbasid period in the Kabul region of eastern Afghanistan. Reading about the relationship between Islam and Buddhism And we're getting back to what I was reading. The next topic is Buddhist-Islamic relations during the Abbasid period. At the start of the period, the Abbasids ruled Bactria, northern Afghanistan, where they allowed the local Buddhists, Hindus, and Zoroastrians to keep the religions if they paid a poll tax. Many, however, voluntarily accepted Islam, especially among the landowners and the educated upper urban classes. Its high culture was more accessible than their own, and they could avoid paying the heavy tax. The Turki Shahis, allied with the Tibetans, ruled Kabul, where Buddhism and Hinduism were flourishing. The Buddhist rulers and spiritual leaders might easily have worried that a similar phenomenon, conversion out of convenience, would happen there. The Turki Shahis ruled the region until 870 CE, losing control of it only between 815 and 819 for 2 years. During those, those 4 years, the Abbasid Caliph al-Ma'mum invaded Kabul and forced the ruling Shah to submit to him and accept Islam. To represent his submission, the Kabul Shah presented the Caliph as a gift, a gold Buddha statue from Subaha Monastery as a sign of the triumph of Islam. Caliph al-Ma'mum sent the enormous statue with its silver throne and jeweled crown to Mecca and displayed it there at the Kaaba for 2 years. In doing so, the Caliph was demonstrating his authority to rule the entire Islamic world after vanquishing his brother in a civil war. He did not force all Buddhists of Kabul to convert, however, nor did he destroy the monasteries. He did not even smash as an idol the Buddha statue that the Kabul Shah had presented him, but sent it instead to Mecca as booty after the Abbasid army withdrew to fight against movements for autonomy. In other parts of the empire, the Buddhist monasteries quickly recovered. The next section, which is of particular interest to me, as I had related this whole thing before I started reading this, that decades ago I was reading in a Buddhist magazine, Mandala, how there was a prediction or prophecy that the world would not be at peace until Islam was conquered. Anyway, I'm going to read this section now. It's not too long. It's called The Correlation Between the Predictions and History. The first Kalki's historical predictions then clearly fit the above times, but mold the events to illustrate lessons. However, as the 13th century Common Era Sakya commentator Bhutan, B-U-T, capital B-U-T-O-N, remarks about the Kalachakra presentation of history, quote, "to scrutinize historical events of the past is meaningless," end quote. Nevertheless, Kai Drubje explains that the predicted war between Shambhala and the non-Indic forces is not merely a metaphor without reference to a future historical reality. If that were so, then when the Kalachakra Tantra applies internal analogies for the planets and constellations, the absurd conclusion would follow that the heavenly bodies exist only as a metaphor and have no external reference. K. Drubji also continues, however, against taking literally the additional Kalachakra prediction that the non-Indic religion will eventually spread to all 12 continents and Rudra Chakran's teachings will overcome it there too. The prediction does not concern the specific non-Indic people described earlier or their religious beliefs or practices. The name Mlecha, M-L-E-C-C-H-A, here merely refers to non-dharmic forces and beliefs that contradict Buddha's teachings. Thus, the prediction is that destructive forces inimical to spiritual practice, and not specifically a Muslim army, will attack in the future, and an external, quote, holy war, quote, against them will be necessary. I'm going to read that sentence again. Thus, the prediction is that destructive forces inimical to spiritual practice, and not specifically a Muslim army, will attack in the future, and an external, quote, holy war, end quote, against them will be necessary. The implicit message is that if peaceful methods fail and one must fight a holy war, the struggle must always base itself on the Buddhist principles of compassion and deep awareness of reality. This is true despite the fact that in practice, this guideline is extremely difficult to follow when training soldiers who are not bodhisattvas. Nevertheless, if the war is driven by the non-Indic principles of hatred, malice, resentment, and prejudice, future generations will see no difference between the ways of their ancestors and those of the non-Indic forces. Consequently, they will easily adopt the non-Indic ways. The Islamic concept of jihad is one of the invader ways. The Islamic concept of jihad? If so, the Kala Chakra accurately describing jihad, or is it using the non-Indic invasion of Shambhala merely to represent an external, merely to represent an extreme to avoid? To avert interfaith misunderstanding, it is important to investigate these questions. The Arabic word jihad means a struggle in which one needs to endure suffering and difficulties, such as hunger and thirst, during Ramadan, the holy month of fasting. Those who engage in this struggle are mujahideen. One is reminded of the Buddhist teachings on patience for bodhisattvas to endure the difficulties of following the path to enlightenment. The Sunni division of Islam outlines five types of jihad. One, a military jihad, is a defensive campaign against aggressors trying to harm Islam. It is not an offensive attack to convert others to Islam by force. Two, a jihad by resources entails giving financial and material support to the poor and needy. Three, a jihad by work is honestly supporting oneself and one's family. Four, a jihad by study is to acquire knowledge. And five, a jihad against oneself is an internal struggle to overcome wishes and thoughts counter to the Muslim teachings. The Shia division of Islam emphasizes the first type of jihad, equating an attack on an Islamic state with an attack on the Islamic faith. Many Shiites also accept the fifth type, the internal spiritual jihad. Similarities between Buddhism and Islam? The Kala Chakra presentation of the mythical Shambhala War and the Islamic discussion of jihad show remarkable similarities. Both Buddhist and Islamic holy wars are defensive tactics for stopping attacks by external hostile forces and never offensive campaigns for winning converts. Both have internal spiritual levels of meaning in which the battle is against negative thoughts and destructive emotions. Both need to be waged based on ethical principles, not on the basis of prejudice and hatred. Thus, in presenting the non-Indic invasion of Shambhala as purely negative, the Kala Chakra literature is in fact misrepresenting the concept of jihad in the prasangika manner of taking it to its logical extreme to illustrate a position to avoid. Moreover, just as many leaders have distorted and exploited the concept of jihad for power and gain, the same has occurred with Shambhala and its discussion of war against destructive foreign forces. Agvan Dorjiev, the late 19th century Common Era Russian Buryat Mongol assistant tutor to the 13th Dalai Lama, proclaimed that Russia was Shambhala and the Tsar was a Kalki. In this way, he tried to convince the 13th Dalai Lama to align with Russia against the Mlecha, M-L-E-C-C-H-A, British, in the struggle for control of Central Asia. In conclusion, just as critics of Buddhism could focus on abuses of Kalachakra's external level of spiritual battle and dismiss the internal level, and this would be unfair to Buddhism as a whole, the same is true regarding anti-Muslim critics of jihad. The advice in the Buddhist tantras regarding the spiritual teacher may be useful here. Almost every spiritual teacher has a mixture of good qualities and faults. Although a disciple must not deny the negative qualities of a teacher, to dwell on them will only cause anger and depression. If instead a disciple focuses on a teacher's positive qualities, he or she will gain inspiration to follow the spiritual path. The same can be said about the Buddhist and Islamic teachings regarding holy wars. Both religions have been abuses of its calls for an external battle when destructive forces threaten religious practice. Without denying or dwelling on these abuses, one can gain inspiration by focusing on the benefits of waging an inner holy war in either creed. Divination. Through an exclusive arrangement with Orgen Yeshe, Tibetan divination expert of the Buddhist Rime Order, Savino Veritas listeners can get their tough questions answered. Through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri's consciousness, seer of all, past, present, and future, Orgen Yeshe reads your question and rolls the blessed red dice for you. In his deep, mantra-induced meditative trance, Orgen Yeshe internalizes your question, throws the sacred dice, and based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for you, captures the emergence of your answer. The price? Contribute what you can at $5 or more. Deposit your offering to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Again, deposit $5 or what you can to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Write a well-thought-out question and send it to tjsavino22@gmail.com along with your self-selected $5 or more contribution to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Savino Veritas will dispatch your answer via email within 3 days of submission. Mo, Tibetan Divination.
Can I trust my boyfriend? plan to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding, May or June?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill the supervisor's job? May I count on my best pitcher to win this game?
How much should I gamble at the casino?
Do I need to go see the doctor about this condition?
Is Atlanta the right place for me to move?
Should we increase our homeowner's insurance?
If I get the job, will it help our relationship?
Will marital therapy keep us together?
Where should I look for my lost ring?
Will I ever find it? Can I?
Can I?
Should he?
Should he?
Will they?
Will they?
When will?
Will.
Can. Questions.
Questions.
Money.
Love.
Renies.
Mo.
Mo. Mo. Tibetan divination. No matter what your religion or none, if there is none for you, you may be struggling with the inner war of questions, unanswered questions. Mo, Tibetan Divination, will help you. Right now, write a well-thought-out question for which you need an answer. Email it to tjsavino22@gmail.com, tjsavino22@gmail.com, and get your answer. Mo, Tibetan Divination. You will find it surprisingly accurate. I can guarantee you that. If you don't, if you're not thoroughly satisfied, you can return the $5 or whatever figure you give to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Make it a good question. Make it a good question. Write a well-thought-out question. You're listening to Tom Savino with Savino Veritas live from Burbank, California. And next Thursday, we're going to be honored with, again, once again, we'll be honored with Dr. Waldar, who will be talking to us about the LIGO principle, L-I-G-O. Now, for the amount of understanding I have on this subject, which is quantum physics and the proof of gravitation, which was discovered in this experiment, the LIGO experiment. For me, it's more like a Lego experiment. That's the degree of intelligence I have on this subject. But Dr. Waldo is kindly willing to put up with my nonsense and stupidity, and hopefully it will be entertaining. It will definitely be enlightening. So join us next week with Dr. Waldar. Thank you for being with us this Thursday night and every Thursday night, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and all the other international times in between. You have been listening to Savino Veritas. Please take it easy and take care. Be with us next week. Thank you.
I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end. By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory. And parallel parking expert, Thomas Savino. The fine wine of select gripes. Savino Veritas, live from Burbank.
I may be joking, but I'm never kidding. Join me each Thursday at 11 p.m. right here on SRN.